Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on the program today, Johannesburg's escalating water crisis has residents seething. A landmark constitutional court ruling says husbands can now legally adopt their wife's surname. We'll look at a rapid deal-making initiative in the Western Cape aimed at fast-tracking job creation, and Gauteng's property market rebound continues. It's Monday, the 15th of September.
MoneyWeb at Midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, South Africa's Constitutional Court has just struck down a law that stopped husbands from taking their wives' surnames, calling it a colonial import and a form of gender-based discrimination. The case was brought by two couples, including a Henry van der Merwe and a Jana Jordaan, who were denied the right to share a family name. Now, the ruling means, as I understand it, Parliament has got to amend the Births and Deaths Registration Act, clearing the way for more equal choices in how families define themselves. Let's talk about this in a little more detail from Lawyers for Human Rights. I'm in conversation now with Mametlwe Sebe. A very warm welcome to you. What does the court's decision then actually change in practice?
Well, Jeremy, greeting. It just means that a couple can actually choose whether to name their new family unit either by the surname of the, you know, either of the partners, where at the present moment, the only way that a person can change their name, that is in the registry, you know, of birth and set, I mean, you know, you know, birth and death history, is on the basis of a woman actually changing to his male marital partner. And the court says, no, in actual fact, the, you know, capacity of a surname to represent, right, a commitment, a love, but also a new family unit, it's a human experience, not a gendered one. And therefore, the option to make the choice of which surname to take has to be available to both partners. Mm. So it means where in the current law, you know, only your wife is allowed to change the surname to you, Jeremy. Now you also have an option that if you want your wife, if you want to take your, you know, your wife's surname, you should be allowed to do so. The option that doesn't exist at the present moment.
It would seem to some a very marginal issue, maybe even an academic issue. I wonder if this request from males often happens.
Well, in actual fact, I mean, it's happening actually all the time. People contrary to what, you know, people believe. I mean, people do that. And this is a thing. They are many instances, Jeremy, where like a male is bearing a surname that doesn't mean much, and in actual fact, that surname is associated with certain traumatic events. I mean, I know of friends of mine that say, well, you know, I got my surname because at the time when I was, you know, growing up, at the time when I was about to be registered, my, you know, mother had this particular boyfriend, and the boyfriend was abusive. He disappeared after. I have no connection with his surname. In actual fact, I want to be able to change it. And the law does not allow that. And there's a problem, right? So you have a situation where in law says now, no, here the husband will also have as much an option to build a new family on the basis of a surname that he believes represents, you know, the kind of or the familiar relation that he wants to build, and in this case, with the people of the wife's husband, with the people of the wife's family, who are probably supportive, who he wants to be part of that. And in actual fact, traditionally, Jeremy, that is what it's happened. There are many people I know, because people say this is an attack on tradition and other things. I know of people who have moved into the clans of their wives, you know, or their mothers, families and other things. My own mother clan actually is part of the Sibeyes, but how they came to our village about 100 years ago is that it was through one of the maternal grandmothers, and they became adopted into that, you know, clan in which she was belonging to after she left the clan where her husband actually originated. It's been happening all the time.
Some say this case is more than just about surnames. It's possibly about breaking down harmful stereotypes in law. I'm wondering if you see this ruling as setting a broader precedent for tackling other outdated or discriminatory practices within the country's legal framework.
The only thing, Jeremy, that should be shocking us is how did it take 30 years for us even to reach this point? How do we have many archaic laws that are simply not corresponding to the democratic values of gender equality, you know, and human dignity, in this case, a personal autonomy over questions of identity, because that is what this is about. Reality is the patriarchal, you know, imposition, which this is, it is based actually on the laws of inheritance that is through a male, you know, linear, and I think is in those cultures where the private property, you know, was, you know, the domain of the husband, where there is a wife and so on, who brought, you know, the lot of the riches, the property accrued to a husband, and therefore any inheritance has to be on that basis. So that is not the reality of our modern law. Never mind the fact that we have different cultures, we have different forms of marriage, including, you know, not the ones between, not just heterosexual marriages, but we have, you know, homosexual marriages and all those things and so on. And this law is just archaic from that point of view.
Right. Just a final question. As I understand it, Parliament has now got to amend the Births and Deaths Registration Act for this ruling to take full effect. Do you see challenges or delays in getting these changes implemented, or do you think it'll be a smooth passage?
Well, I mean, I've been doing lots of interviews in the, you know, mainly African language stations, and I'm just shocked by the reaction. Even the notion, by the way, that the concept of surnames we have is part of culture and tradition. That's just very strange to me, because we didn't have surnames in a way that we have them today, right? I can tell you, traditionally, my father would be named after his, I mean, the surname of my father would be that of his grandfather, right? And then we'll have a clan. And the reason you see such a mixed bag in terms of surnames in South Africa, where there are people called Modawu and others. Modawu just means somebody whose totem is a lion. My totem is a lion, but nobody suggests that my surname would be that. I'm Sibeyi, but Sibeyi is actually my clan. My grandfather, that is the father of my father, actually, his surname in the ID was the name of his father, which is Njile. His son took the name of the clan. So this idea, I mean, the surnames that we have today have their origin in medieval Europe, you know, based on the roles of people. Metal workers will be your smith, you know, people in baking will be your bakers, but others is just designating that this is a son of something. Either it's Jackson, I mean Johnson, the son of John, Jackson, the son of Jack, whatever thing, so on. It was about the colonial control, the way that it was imposed, people had to register, and the way that the surnames, as you know them today amongst African communities, is about how people are translating questions in terms of, you know, where do you belong? Who are you? Some will say Sibeyi, meaning the clan. Some will say I'm the father, son of this. Some will say this is my totem. And that's how you have surnames that are not really represent reality. So the challenge will be misplaced, will be a mistake, but also it will just be unnecessary, but it will be there. But nonetheless, I think the court was very clear. I can't see how it can be decided in other way.
Thank you very much indeed. That's Mametlwe Sibeyi from the organization Lawyers for Human Rights.
MoneyWeb at midday. For all your up-to-date stories.
Now, I don't need to tell you, Johannesburg is in the grip of a full-blown water crisis, weeks without supply in some areas, infrastructure crumbling, and public anger now spilling into the streets. Officials blame technical glitches, but experts say years of neglect and political inertia are to blame. I want to talk about this with Dr. Farrell Adam from the civil society organization Water Can. Dr. Adam, a very warm welcome. You've pointed to missing political will. In your view, who is specifically ducking accountability here? Is it the mayor? Is it Johannesburg Water or national government?
Good morning, Jeremy, and thank you for having me on your show. I think that we can, if we look at the historical kind of context, because that's where we are right now, the neglect can be attributed to all levels of government. I do think that in the recent past, national government has been pushing and changing and being better. So I think at the end of the day, when it comes to the municipalities, then the mayors and the mayoral committees must actually start, you know, facing the music on this one.
The city, Dr. Adams, says demand is too high, and that's a direct quote. Is that, in your opinion, a credible excuse or simply a way to mask years of underinvestment?
So I think it is one of the reasons, right? Because let me explain this, is that we have in city of Johannesburg, half of our reservoirs are leaking. So they cannot be filled to maximum. So there's no storage. But at the same time, it is known that as we go into summer months, we use more water. But also when they talk about the high demand, they must also understand that we are losing at least 27% of our water to leaks in the city of Joburg. So that's also part of that high demand, right? And that's the challenge, but it's a combination of that. They can't only say it's high demand. They've got to say that the demand is high given the poor state of our infrastructure and the fact that we've ignored it for 10 years.
What I'm also hearing you say is that it's probably going to get worse as we approach the hot summer months in Gauteng.
We probably will see some restrictions. I think it's not about having the Vaal River system at 100% or anything, but I do think that there may be some restrictions in the pipeline.
And Dr. Adam, we've got this thing called stop-start supply and throttling. And you'll correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to me to be the new routine. From an engineering perspective, are these emergency measures creating bigger long-term failures, do you think?
So, yes, I mean, I'm not an engineer, but that is what our engineers have told us, is that the throttling is actually going to make the system more vulnerable to leaks and burst pipes. So we would see, so what we have now, Jeremy, is no flow. But when we start seeing flow normalizing, and they'll throttle at night and open in the morning, as more of these areas start getting water, you're going to get a lot more leaks and a lot more burst pipes around the city.
But if we don't throttle, surely the situation will get worse a whole lot quicker.
No, I mean, I think what engineers are saying is that it's better to have some level of water in the pipes rather than leaving them empty. Because when you think about the pipes being empty and they're fragile, they're actually breaking where they are. So you've got to keep some level of water in them. So you could reduce supply, but there are other sustainable ways that they can do it. The engineers would be the ones to actually answer that better. But I think having a certain amount of water within the pipes is better than having nothing and dry pipes. Mm.
Dr. Adam, there's been a huge amount of anger and rage over Brixton and Hurst Hill, particularly in Johannesburg, projects there being repeatedly delayed. Do you have a view on that? Is it incompetence? Is it corruption? Is it a lack of will? What is it, do you think?
I think that it's a combination of lack of will. It's a combination of poor planning. And I think it's this arrangement that the city of Joburg has that, and the city of Joburg, as it stands, is a leaking bucket of money. So they allocate money to the entities, but they then would take from Joburg Water and then use it to pay other things, which historically was the decision that the money-making parts or arms of the city would be your water, your rates, your electricity and waste. So you'll pay those and that will be able to fund other parts of the city, like parks or whatever comes with it, right? What we see now is that the city keeps saying that they don't have money. So it's worrying. They allocate a budget to Joburg Water, which was a very measly increase for capital expenditure. But they have the ability to take that money back into their account, which then leaves Joburg Water strapped because they can't pay contractors, and then contractors down tools. The Brixton Reservoir, the new one, was supposed to be online April, May this year. It has been delayed because contractors down tools. And I believe that there may be a problem right now as we speak, but it just extends these issues, which then extends our challenges on the ground.
And the consequence, Dr. Adam, of this budgeting hopscotch that you're describing to me is a loss of trust as far as communities are concerned. And if there is a breakdown in social contract, it will have a huge impact on future cooperation when it comes to water saving or, for that matter, tariff increases.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that is exactly the challenge we're having right now, because we're trying to say, look, even when you're getting water, we need to use it sparingly so that the water can go longer, so that everybody can have a little bit. But people are like, well, then I'm not going to save water if Joburg Water's not fixing their leaks. So it's, you know, people are so angry that they don't want to even hear saving. They were like, what must I save? I haven't had water for 10 days. So it becomes very difficult. And the trust, you're right, there's a complete trust deficit with city officials and Joburg Water. And building that is going to take a lot of honesty and transparency from the officials, but also an understanding and empathy, which I don't see from any of the mayor's inputs or any of his engagements, that there's an understanding of what people are going through on the ground.
Now, if I understand this correctly, legally, residents shouldn't have to endure more than a week without water a year. Have you applied your mind at all to the chances of a successful constitutional or class action challenge?
Yes. And by the way, it's not even 7 days. It doesn't even say seven consecutive days, right? So it could be 7 days across a year. We have been chatting to a number of legal minds. I think we've been so busy at the moment just trying to make sure that people get water on the ground in this period, because it's been so long. And because a legal case is a long-term kind of approach. What we did think about is having an interdict, and we will be talking to people to say, how do we ensure that the money is ring-fenced for the water and sanitation? We're not saying all of the budget, but at least for the projects that they have identified in the short term that they've submitted to the presidential working group, at least those projects can happen without any hindrance. That would be a good thing. But we know that court cases take time, so we are having discussions around that. And what is our avenue? What is the best avenue at the moment?
And just a quick one in conclusion. Obviously, we're focusing on Johannesburg, but how does it compare with other metros at the moment? Is this a unique collapse that we're witnessing in real time, or a broader national failure when it comes to water governance?
It's a snapshot of a very, very big, broad national failure. If I tell you that, you know, there are areas like for years, Balfour, that in Mpumalanga, that have not been able to drink the water from their tap because it's polluted. There are areas in Makanda, the Free State, I can give you every province where and municipalities where there are challenges with water. And when communities are trying to engage with municipalities there, it's even worse. They just get silent treatment. They don't get acknowledged. And it's, you know, from KZN to the Western Cape, there are issues. If you look at the Western Cape with sewage flowing into the rivers, into the beaches. So really, it is a national crisis, water and sanitation across the board. The fact that 25% of our schools don't have proper running water and 45% of our clinics don't have running water is a crisis.
Thank you very much indeed. I've been in conversation with Dr. Ferial Adam from the civil society organization Water Can.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Later this year, Cape Town will host the inaugural Western Cape Investment Summit. It's being billed as the launch pad for a trillion rand provincial economy growing at 5% a year. But here's my question. Can a province realistically deliver where South Africa has struggled, battling weak growth, fragile infrastructure and policy inertia? Well, someone who's got the answer to that is Rashid Tufi, who is Deputy Director General for Economic Development and Tourism in the Western Cape Government. DDG, a very warm welcome to you. The Growth for Jobs strategy, as I've just mentioned, targeting a trillion rand economy growing at 5% annually. But what hard evidence do you have that this is achievable, given that the broader national economy is stuck well below 2% and has been the case for the past couple of years?
Hi, Jeremy. It's a goal. It's a target. It's an audacious target, which I'm I come from the private sector, and it's nice to have a government that sets its sights high. It's a 2035 strategy. So it's not something we believe will happen immediately, but we have this audacious target to say if we want to beat the curve and actually make an impact on unemployment and grow the economy, we have to set the target high. We understand the inertia from other parts of government, but I think there are various things being done that if all the sort of stars align and we get some of the things at Operation Vulindlela right, and some of the global geopolitical challenges go in our favor, then we'll have a better chance. But and our target isn't a hard 5% at all. It's stated as sort of 4 to 6%, but it's always relative to externalities and other factors, Jeremy.
All, of course, predicated, as you say, on overcoming that national inertia. How do you get that ball rolling?
Well, first of all, we're part of the national picture, and we very much sit on all the platforms, as I said, with Operation Vulindlela, some of the work that BLSA is doing to keep a track of the sort of institutional changes that are being done. So what we do is try to make sure that Western Cape is an example where we are really pushing a kind of different kind of mindset in terms of creating this enabling environment for businesses to thrive, and then working with organizations. Our current successes at the Cape Town Port, for example, comes from a direct engagement with Transnet to say, what can we do as business, as regional governments, to support the fixing of some of our binding constraints. So that's all we can do, hey, is to continue to do what we can do in the Western Cape well, and then lobby and be part of the success story of fixing some of that inertia at a national level.
As I understand it, you're courting sectors like green energy, agribusiness and tourism. But are there specific policy or regulatory reforms that you would need to commit to in order to de-risk investment?
I don't think it's required. I mean, I think the government has made a very clear intent about focusing on the green economy. Like, for example, the Western Cape corridor with the Northern Cape all the way up to Namibia is the stated target area for green hydrogen investment. And so there's an absolute both international attention to that and focus. Similarly with tourism, there isn't a policy directive that needs to decide on whether we can attract tourism investment. We're doing all the right things, getting more direct flights. We are positioning the Western Cape as a growing economy for tourists, for meetings, for conferences. And that's why you see an inflow of investment into that area. So I don't think there's any policy, national policy, regulatory binding constraints that stop us from driving investment. And hence, of course, I'll push for this investment summit in November.
DDG, global investors, I guess, would be weighing the Western Cape in a very strong case that you're making against other emerging markets. I'm thinking of Kenya, maybe Vietnam, or even Morocco. What do you see as your strongest competitive differentiator?
Well, first of all, I think, I mean, ironically, we look at our unemployment, this youth dividend, but actually a market with skilled, trained labor force who are unemployed are actually it's a real asset. It's one of the assets that people look to when they want to invest. We have good, clean government here, and it's an absolute. We argue that we are the digital Silicon Valley of Africa, and I think we come across we've successfully positioned ourselves as a go-to place for innovation, something that's open for creative industries, for media. So I think we've got a strong academic base, strong institutional universities, good governance, and then great access to markets. I mean, through the port, we have our international flight program. When I joined government just 7 years ago, we had 2 or 3 direct flights. We're now at 22 direct flights, and that makes a very big difference for both boxes in the belly as well as people on the seats, you know, to move around Africa.
Just a final one. The Western Cape, of course, has attracted private capital before, but I would suggest, and correct me if I'm wrong, that often this is skewed to the Cape Town Metro. Your biggest difficulty, I'd suggest to you, is spreading opportunities to regional regions that are most in need of jobs. If you agree with the premise, how do you do it?
Mm-hmm. Well, what we did in June is we had a municipal economic investment summit where we got every mayor every municipal manager together, and we help them to identify investment ready. And what we will do, not sure if we have some time for me to tell you about our investment summit in November.
I'm really pressed for time. The question is, is how you're gonna spread the love.
So the way we do that is our investment summit is taking place November 5th to 7th. And what we'll be doing is we've got over 100 investment-ready projects going right across the province, and we'll be attracting international investors and then doing a matchmaking exercise. And that includes very much projects outside of the metro.
Rashid Tufi, thank you very much indeed. Deputy Director General for Economic Development and Tourism in the Western Cape Government.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, it's good to read that Gauteng's housing market is bouncing back, with Tshwane posting double-digit growth and Johannesburg, would you believe, finally showing some signs of life. But beneath the headlines, I think there are some tough questions. Is this recovery real? Is it sustainable? And who is really benefiting? I'm in conversation now with the Chief Executive Officer of Uber Home Loans, Gavin Lomberg. A very warm welcome. So let's look at Tshwane first of all. Values are surging. In your opinion, genuine demand, or maybe just a bubble, a credit-fueled bubble?
Thanks for having me, Jeremy. From our perspective, genuine demand. We've seen quite a nice uptick quarter on quarter for two consecutive three-month periods within the Gauteng and specifically the Tshwane market, where we've seen a steady increase of 10% in first-time homebuyer demand within Tshwane and 15% in second-time homebuyer demand. So that is really encouraging. If one looks all over the two quarters, we've seen a six-month trend and steady pickup in demand within the Tshwane node.
Gavin, perhaps not quite as positive, but nonetheless encouraging. Johannesburg ticking up by 5%. Is this the start of a turnaround, do you think?
Similarly, we're seeing similar trends there. Quarter on quarter, the prior quarter showed a 3% growth. This specific quarter that encompasses April to June, we saw a 5% growth. And that's off the back of virtually, you know, no growth for the previous 12 months. So we do think that it's obviously a function of a favorable rate environment, Jeremy. We've seen 125 basis point reduction in interest rates over the last 12-month period. And we do therefore think that that is what's fueling home buyer appetite, underpinned by ever, you know, favorable bank lending appetite within Gauteng and Tshwane.
But Gavin, you'd agree with me, this recovery is also perhaps exposed to an extent if there is another interest rate shock.
That's obviously the one sort of concern that may scupper the current momentum. All indications are, though, you know, in engaging with the major bank economists, would seem to support steady sort of interest rate and inflation rate conditions, although it's just ticked up ever so slightly to 3.5 now. The view from most of the major banks economists are that interest rates will remain steady for the next 6 months. It's highly unlikely we will see a rate cut within the next month or two, but they still do envisage further 25 basis point cut for the next 6 months. And then potentially in Q2 of 2026, we may see a further 25% basis point cut. So those seem to be, you know, the forecasts that would support, you know, continued growth and momentum in those regions.
And Gavin Lomberg, at this point, do you think that banks are underwriting this growth responsibly, or are they pushing volume in what is still a fragile market?
I think bank appetite's never been stronger. All indications are that banks are quite comfortable with the risk appetite. And we see that more so in the fact that around 10-12% of all loans are in fact at 100% loan to value level. So clearly the banks, and that is not unique to one of the so-called big five, if one includes Investec, I think that's the trend across the big five, is that they see sufficient value in extending loans even at 100%, and in some cases 105% loan to value, and that the risk is adequately provision for. And I think coming back to Tshwane and Gauteng specifically, it's also underpinned by rising growth in income. So Tshwane, for example, in the last quarter showed a 14% growth in income, which is quite significant if you think of your inflationary growth that normally sits at around 3.54%. And then similarly in Gauteng, we've seen a 5% growth in year-on-year income levels. So that obviously factors in, and the fact that you've got a big portion of second-time home buyers, there's obviously collateral against which those loans are being extended. So, you know, banks are obviously taking that into consideration, and obviously their risk appetite remains quite favorable.
It's interesting you mentioned second-time home buyers, because that says to me that investor appetite in Tshwane is rising. But is there a danger that over time that could risk crowding out first-time home buyers who are on something of a purchase trajectory anyway?
Not necessarily. The single biggest challenge, you know, sort of in the 6 months prior to the last two growth spurts has actually been an oversupply of stock. So stock has never been the big challenge in areas like Tshwane and Gauteng, unlike, you know, the very unique challenge that lack of stock offers in areas like the Western Cape. So I think the combination of favorable interest rates, improved income, bigger appetite within first-time home buyers that are not, that's sort of ticking up to 50% of all new buyers being first-time home buyers, and, you know, a favorable, more affordable properties for market with an oversupply of stock. I think that is that forecast, you know, the conditions are there for sustained favorable performance within the Tshwane and Gauteng sectors.
And Gavin, just a final question. I also read that Gauteng has now overtaken the Western Cape in new builds. Are we building for need or for speculation or a bit of both?
Yeah, I mean, it's always a tricky one. What we are seeing is quite a few developments sort of respawning and spurning in the Gauteng North and Gauteng East environments. It is somehow offset by the fact that if one looks at the population of Gauteng, that has grown by 6 million people just in the last two decades. And the lion's share of that 25% is your sort of middle income population that typically thrive and would look to, you know, buy in development type environments. So clearly, you know, the view in that specific space is that there is sufficient demand, you know, for those sort of properties, and it will be sustainable in the long run.
Thank you very much indeed. That's Gavin Lomberg, who's Chief Executive Officer of Uber Home Loans. And that's where we're going to leave it. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We're here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.